You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk podcast on KCPW, kcpw.org, bff.fm, and kfog.com. It's day six with the 2019 Sundance Film Festival. I'm John Wildman, and we are on location at Slamdance headquarters on historic Main Street, interviewing some of this year's most important and exciting voices in independent film. Joining me this morning are my co-hosts from Bitch Talk, Aaron Lim and Angela Tabora. On today's show, we're going to start off with a glad LGBTQ Shorts roundtable. With that, we have Anthony Ramos. He's the director of talent engagement at GLAAD. Jeremy Blacklow, he's the director of entertainment media. And two shorts, Lavender and Fran This Summer. We have the documentary Maiden. We have Alex Holmes, the director, Victoria Gregory, the producer, as well as Tracy Edwards, the subject of that film. We'll do a remote interview with the people from MOPE, and we'll have the director, Lucas Hain, along with the cast members, including David Arquette. And then we finish up with the film Dirty God, and we have the star, Vicky Knight, from that film, as well as the director, Sasha Pollock. You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast. My name is John Wildman. I'm here with my Bitch Talk co-hosts, Aaron Lim and Angela Tabora. We've got a great segment here, a couple cool films to talk about, and a couple representatives from GLAAD. The films are Lavender, Matthew Puccini, the director of that film, is here. Fran This Summer, Mary Evangelista, the director and writer of that film, is here. And then from GLAAD, we've got Anthony Ramos. He's the director of talent engagement. And Jeremy Blacklow, the director of entertainment media. Everybody, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Let's start off with the movies, because we're talking about movies here. Lavender. Matthew, tell us about Lavender.
Oh, boy. Lavender is a short film, and it's about a young gay man who grows increasingly entangled in the marriage of an older gay couple. The gay couple's played by Michael Urie and Ken Barnett, and the younger character is played by Michael Sue Rosen, and it's this kind of tender, poignant little look at an unconventional relationship as it blossoms and then ultimately unravels.
Absolutely. And Mary, just tell us about Fran This Summer.
Sure. It's about a young teenage couple and their first love, this big love, and one of them wishing to transition. And it's a summer where they stay in and try to stay in as much as possible, and then they go to the beach where their love is on display and everything kind of comes to head. It's just like a very small, tender moment in their relationship.
I love both of these films.
Mm-hmm. And thank you.
And also, full disclosure, I'm also the publicist for AGLIF, the All Genders, Lifestyles, and Identities Film Festival down in Austin. And these two films do what I love about the programming at that film festival, in that they open us up to relationships and worlds in a way that is loving and that is caring and non-exploitative. And I want to start with Lavender, because there is a gentleness to this film.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that was a goal from the beginning, was to, you know, try and put something on screen that, you know, the word we keep using is tender.
Yeah.
And I love that word, because I think too often, especially in a lot of the queer films that I grew up watching, it felt like they either had to skew towards camp or towards tragedy, and wanting to kind of maybe carve out a space in between those two things for something that was just a little bit more gentle and a little bit more true to my own experiences and the experiences of the community of people around me. So, you know, speaking of movies that have premiered in Austin, one of the big, you know, references for me always is Andrew Haig's Weekend, mm-hmm. just in terms of the gentleness of that and wanting to kind of continue to update that narrative and show relationships and characters on screen that are specifically queer but also feel so accessible to, you know, anyone in the audience who has ever experienced a complicated relationship.
Well, talk about, you know, directing these three guys and talk about, you know, how, what measures you took to affect that nuance.
Mm.
Because, you know, because there is a little tension.
Yeah.
You know, but you're not going to, you know, any sense of melodrama whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a wonderful nuance to it. So talk about how you achieve that.
Well, I really have to credit the three actors, and they made my work very easy for me because unbeknownst to us when we cast all three of them, they all knew each other from previous projects coming onto our set. So even in our early rehearsals, there was already such an incredible rapport and dynamic between the three of them, and just a lot of trust that I think allowed us to kind of skip some of the steps in the rehearsal process and really start to just, you know, unpack what we were trying to do. And you know, they're all three just really smart, outspoken gay men who brought a lot of personal experience to the film. And I think we're able to imbue all of their performances with the nuance that you're talking about. So, you know, all I did was, you know, give them a script and really kind of give them some references for what I wanted it to feel like. And that was, you know, a combination of some films and some photographs and some music. And then from there on set, it was really just letting the three of them play and you know, turning on the camera.
And Fran, this summer, Mary, again, there have been, in the last couple of years, some really nice films dealing with the aspect of transitioning and the process of that. And some, I think, have handled it really, really well, from my viewpoint, and some, you know, still trying to find their way. Mm-hmm. Talk about your approach on this film.
Sure. Well, it was really imperative for me to find and to work with, for casting Fran, to work with a trans or non-binary or transitioning person. And it was something that was quite difficult to find a friend. And I found, I was very lucky how I met Zenobia, the star of the film. She performed at Metropolitan, which is a gay bar, during Pride. And she came out with Beyonce's Grown Woman, and I was floored, and she was gorgeous. And then I asked her if I could, if we could meet for coffee, and then I talked about my work, and I've always been exploring gender and sexuality, and we just really connected that way. And then just working through the script, showing her the script, and then changing it a little bit once we got Emily, who plays Angie, on board, so that it was always about these two characters, these two friends that are lovers, and what would it mean if you're both growing, but you have this deep love. And I think that's where it really came from. And I'm sorry, I'm like wondering where I miss, if I miss, if I answered.
I think you've answered it wonderfully.
Yeah,
I'm like, oh.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add how much I love these two shorts.
Yeah. thank you so much.
If I can just be a fan person for a minute. Like, they are so beautiful, and everyone needs to check them out. I mean, it is very hard, I think, in 2019 to do a transition story well. Mm-hmm. And even the title of the panel we're doing is Beyond the Transition,
mm-hmm. right.
know, narrative. Mm-hmm. Fran is one of the mm-hmm. most beautiful, again, go back to Tender. This is how to do it right.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, that was the thing that, you know, that I was thinking the entire time. And again, it's that, you know, bringing that down to, you know, an emotional level where you know the emotions are there, and you know you don't need to speak things out loud to see, and it really does capture. This moment in someone's life, and you know, and the thoughts racing through both their heads.
I really think it was their performances, and I know for both of them it was their first time acting as well, so they were very vulnerable and all these things. And I think for me, even as a director, it was such a learning experience. This whole process of even writing it and having to go back and realizing, like, wow, there's so much to unpack within, like, being like, wow, maybe I'm more genderqueer than I thought, or like, because I feel like I've always been going between two worlds. I'm Filipino, and
me too.
So is our producer Shar.
I love it.
So we have like a lot of trans folks in the Philippines, and they're just widely accepted. But then there's also this idea of, like, you wear your cloak, where you don't speak about your, there's no really coming out, like coming out as a new thing. So I think the whole with Fran's younger sister Max, and how they tease each other or goad at each other and are mean with each other, that's like similar to my own experiences. Mm. My sibling and I are both gay, and it made it difficult, it made it hard to really come out and be who we were. And I think that was a lot of that stuff went in there. And it was very like, whoa, I didn't realize that when I was writing it, but it did happen looking back now.
You know, I'd love for all four of you to talk about something that I think that I see at Aglyph when I'm there. And it's a community of filmmakers that are supporting each other and working on each other's projects and coming in at different levels to help push each other forward. Mm-hmm. And yes, that does happen with filmmakers everywhere. But for the LGBTQ community, you know, I'm struck each year that I'm at Aglyph by the strength of those relationships and the pure desire that I see for someone to push another director up and get them out there. And I'd love for each one of you to talk.
I'd love to start off by talking about one of Mary's producers, Elegance Bratton, because this is kind of a fun story that I think ties it all together. A few years ago, before I even worked at GLAAD, Elegance had received a GLAAD grant early on in his career. And then last year at Sundance, we sort of reconnected with him. And Elegance is also behind the recently GLAAD Media Award nominated Viceland series, My House, which everyone should check out if you haven't. And it's really cool to watch how Elegance, who's probably any day now going to blow up and be the biggest thing in the entire world, you should know his name, is now here this year promoting Mary's project as a producer, not as a director. And he ties into GLAAD, and his partner Chester is also amazing. And
they've been my advisors, and I mean, it's been really great to have them. Like, really, I'm so sort of like innocent and new to this, and it's like feels nice to have some like really good folks that have my back, and that's Chester and Elegance for sure.
Yeah.
It just goes to show all those communities and how they come together and
family.
How I think,
I mean, at the end of the day, you know, it's so important, and I think. You know, I'm glad, like, that's something that we really, like, like to remind people that we're here to help and amplify and, you know, celebrate and not just, you know. I think in the beginning, GLAAD started as a different thing, as kind of more like the watchdog, like the don't do this, you're doing this wrong. But now it's all about amplifying and celebrating and coming together, so.
Mm-hmm. Well, fantastic. Again, we've been talking to Anthony Ramos and Jeremy Blacklow from GLAAD, and our two filmmakers, Matthew Puccini from Lavender and Marianne Evangelista from Fran This Summer. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks so much.
Thanks. Thank you.
You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast. My name is John Wildman, here with the Bitch Talk co-hosts Aaron Lim and Angela Tabora. On this segment, we're going to talk about the film Maiden. We have with us the director of the film, Alex Holmes, producer, Victoria Gregory, and the subject of the film, Tracy Edwards. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to start this off. Alex, introduce our viewers to, or our listeners to the film.
Well, this is the incredible and inspiring story of how Tracy, who was someone who had a difficult teenage years and who'd left school before taking any exams, and I say that with her sitting right next to me looking rather embarrassed.
Out of love.
But it's the truth. How she had a dream to enter the round the world yacht race. The only way she could get a spot on a boat was as a cook. So she did the first race in 1985. Had an amazing experience, but a limited experience because basically she was kept below decks. She was with a crew of 17 men, and she finished that race and thought, actually, I'd love to do that again, but this time with a crew of all women. She thought that was a fairly straightforward proposition. She was about to find otherwise.
Yeah.
And she faced the most incredible barrage of chauvinism, people saying that there was no way these women would be capable of doing it physically, mentally, emotionally. But Tracy believed in herself, and she believed in the crew that she put together. By putting in extreme effort and huge sacrifices, she managed to get a boat together and get it to the start line. They took part in the race. And to everybody's expectation, exceeded everybody's expectations. And it's the story of how that race unfolded and how it transformed the place of women in sailing, but also how it transformed Tracy and the rest of the crew.
Yes, we were. Good. Yeah, that was. I know. I think we can end it there. That was just perfect. No, we were, especially Aaron and I were just so moved by this film. At one point, I was standing up screaming and cheering. I love how you describe that you had a team of misfits and nomads. We were at a women's panel a few days ago, and I think it was Kira Sedgwick said, "I'd rather have a team that's maybe a little bit green, but they're going to be so passionate, and they're going to have so much to prove, and they're going to be so dedicated." And I think one part of the film that proves that is when Joe, one of your crew members, breaks her wrist, mm-hmm. and she comes back and meets you at the next leg.
Yeah.
Like, can you talk about your team and just how dedicated they were, and how you just kind of picked them? Someone said a good joke at a bar, and you're like, "Oh, you should be on my crew."
Yeah. Yeah, I'd love to say it was better planned than that, but it really wasn't. I guess I was very instinctive about the team that I picked. I mean, obviously, I knew they were great sailors, and each of them had a skill that we could improve on in some cases, and some of them, you know, went and did a bit more work and learning. But at the end of the day, it was characters, because I had just sailed around the world with 17 men. That was a long 9 months, I can tell you. Wow. And understanding the frictions that can happen at sea. I mean, I think women are a lot easier anyway, but... you know, you still have to have the right characters. And what we ended up with was this great team of very diverse characters. And we all ended up playing off one another. And, you know, we had Sal the Joker, who was always joking. And she was always coming up with the one-liners, as she does in the film. And Joe, who's very caring, who did all the filming. You know, and you can really see that side of her. When I've looked at some of the shots which I didn't know existed, and I've thought of her behind the camera filming someone in a moment of silence, or in a moment of thought, or in my case, a moment of and you know, I've really probably I think what Alex has done really well is he's really highlighted who these characters were. And I think what's really interesting about what you've just said about as well is about being green, because I was the only one who sailed around the world, mm-hmm. and so we did have this quite green team, but it ended up being to our advantage, because we had no preconceived ideas. You know, there was no one on the boat going, "Oh, we don't do it like that," mm-hmm. you know, and that dreadful phrase. We were like, "Well, how? We're not as strong as the guys. How do we do this? Mm-hmm. How do we make that work? Mm-hmm. Well, let's try this. Oh no, let's do that." You know, and so it was a complete collaboration. Not to say that when you go to sea, I do become a dictator, because I have to be, and because you need a skipper that's mm-hmm. going to, you know, that people will know that they can listen to, and are going to tell decisions. Them what to do. Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. They don't want you to ask their opinion when you're in a storm. You know, they're like, "Doesn't she know what to do?"
Right.
Oh my goodness.
Maybe it helped that you knew not to. You may have been more afraid had you had more experience, because it was frightening at times. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I knew what was coming, but no one else did. I mean, there were moments in the Southern Ocean where a couple of people looked at me and went, "Yeah, you didn't tell us about this bit."
Yeah.
Yeah. You said it was a little bit cold and the waves were a little bit high. Not this, you know. Oh, did I not mention that? No, you know. So, but we just, it was a growing experience. You know, we started off, not really knowing what we were doing, mm-hmm. but we ended up at the end of the race, you know, a pretty tight-knit team who could have probably gone on and done anything we wanted.
Well, I think actually at the end of the race, it's one interesting. One of the things that you said when we interviewed you was that, you know, in the last stages of the race, there was almost no need to speak.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because you just knew each other mm-hmm. so well by that stage. You were just so tuned into each other, and the boat was sailing, and the operation of the boat was so smooth. And I think that really comes across in the footage. It's really revealing just how you had bonded together as a crew. And I think that's one of the things that's very satisfying about the film, seeing those relationships develop.
Yeah. I think also in guys' boats, there's probably a lot of shouting. Sorry, I sounded like I'm being really sexist here. I don't mean to be. But we are just different. We're just different the way that we are. Mm-hmm. So I remember one of the guys saying to me at one of the stopovers, "Oh, you girls not speaking then at the start?" "I'm not speaking."
Right.
We're speaking. What are you? And he said, "Well, your boat's completely quiet." I went, "Just because we don't yell at each other all the time doesn't mean to say we're annoyed with each other."
I want to touch upon the fact about the word feminist, and that in this film, you know, I read the description and I'm watching and like, man, she's a badass feminist. And then you say in the film, "I'm not a feminist," and then that changes. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, when I grew up in the 70s in the UK, feminism was not a great word.
It's a bad word.
Various forces had turned it into a bad word, mm-hmm. and they'd taken ownership of it, and they'd taken it away from women. They'd made it into a horrible word that we didn't want ownership of. and it had, I think, taken the wind out of our sails. I'm sorry, excuse the pun. Sorry. I felt that I was young and I didn't know what I was saying. I wasn't political. I didn't even know I had a battle on my hands. I was just at the beginning of this journey, and I'm a feminist. No, goodness, no, God, don't put me in that category. But it was that discovery that feminism is not a bad word. Feminism means equality and fairness, and that was what we were doing. So bit by bit, and I think we were all like this, you know, we were all very nervous of this word, mm-hmm. whereas I think towards the end we'd taken ownership of it, you know, and I look at my daughter's generation and they look mm-hmm. at feminism as a completely different thing, as a powerful, positive, mm-hmm. as men do now, you know, you see mm-hmm. men wearing this is what a feminist looks like, right. and you've got mm-hmm. men on the Women's March, mm-hmm. and, you know, this is an amazing change, I think, that's happening, and it's all positive.
And for Alex and Victoria, can you both talk about how you first heard about this story, how you connected, and why you thought this was something that you really wanted to be a part of? We can start with
Alex. You should go first.
Well, so I encountered Tracy. I can remember it like it was yesterday. The evening my daughter left her elementary school, age 11, to their great credit, the school had fixed up a guest speaker to come and talk to the students who were moving on, and that guest speaker was Tracy. And,
wow. Your daughter's very lucky.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. She is, but so am I.
Yeah. Yeah.
Through her, so am I, because Tracy told the story and it was gripping from the first time I heard it. And it was also obvious to me that Tracy was a remarkable character. The way that she engaged these 11-year-old kids and had them on the edge of their seat, and I was on the edge of my seat too, I thought this is a fantastic story and that I would love to tell it in a film. I assumed that because most of the story happens at sea, in the middle of nowhere, a long way from land, that mm-hmm. we would have to kind of recreate it in a drama.
Yeah.
But then when I spoke to Tracy the next day, she said, well, you know, yeah, I'm surprised it hasn't really been done because we had a camera on board whole way around.
Oh, you hold mine of
yeah.
yeah, it's
and,
incredible.
And that was music to my ears because yeah. I started out as a documentarian and it's my first love. So the chance to make a documentary about this was just a gift. Then we had to go about finding the footage, which was a story in itself, Victoria.
Yeah. So you kind of said to me, oh, come and meet Tracy. And yeah, just an amazing meeting. And it's like, we have to make this film. It's just one of those stories that I have a 7-year-old daughter as well. And it's like, I believe, like you're saying with feminism, it was a dirty word, but I don't mm-hmm. think it is now. And it's like, where we go from here and what this film can encourage everybody to do. But it was a journey of discovery and things that Tracy had never seen. So we got material that you'd had in your loft and yeah. stored away from your mum. And it's just this kind of treasure trove of material that we had to go through.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Tracy's mom because this is she has some of the best one-liners. I want to say she's talking about how proud of you she is, and she says, "I can't believe a little horror grew up to do this." And I'm like, "Oh my God, I love you." That's
what your parents say about you.
Okay, I can relate maybe, but anyway, that's beside the point. You know, brought tears to my eyes. So that's just I love this relationship that you have with your mother, and so it was just more than on one level of for all women, but it even your relationship with your mother grew from
it was
as
so
well.
Special. We'd been through a very tough time, my mother and I, and when I left home at the age of, you know, just turned 16, I can't believe she let me go. But I think she thought I would
actually trying to stop you. Can you imagine what that would have been like?
Yeah.
You
know, this is very true. But then I think of letting my daughter go exactly, anywhere, yeah. anywhere at the age of 16. Like, you know, but I think she knew instinctively that I had to get out of there and that my only chance of any sort of life was not there. And she had to get me away. And she couldn't go, but I could. But what I did was I hated her for a number of years and I blamed her for my stepfather. Mm-hmm. But then I didn't ever tell her about my stepfather, so how could she know? But mm-hmm. I expected her on some level to understand.
She's supposed to read your mind.
Absolutely. She was supposed to be telepathic and I completely blamed her for that. So we went through a time where, I mean, I didn't call, I didn't write for years. She must have been wondering. And now, of course, I'm a mum. I know, God, exactly how that feels. And for years, I never got in touch. And then it was really the Whitbread, doing the H586 Whitbread, that brought us back together again. Because before I went around the world with the guys, I again asked her, you know, of her opinion before we did Maiden. And that's when we realised that, you know, we'd kind of gone beyond mother and daughter and we were going to become friends mm-hmm. and we could leave that horrible bit behind us, and we never really talked about it because didn't need to. Mm-hmm. She'd left him, and you know, and when I moved to Hamble to do Maiden, she moved to Hamble with me. Mm-hmm. And I think most people think your mother moved with you, isn't that a bit weird? But it wasn't. It was brilliant because she was just up the road, and when I needed those moments of going to say, you know, I don't think I can do this, and I don't, what am I doing? And you know, she was right there. But wow, she was just so amazingly strong. I mean, she was my role model, and then, but her mother was her role model. So, some pretty strong women in our family.
Cheers to that.
Yes. A film featuring a very strong woman, four very strong women. The film is Maiden, and we've had the director, Alex Holmes, producer, Victoria Gregory, here, and of course, we've had Tracy Edwards here. Thank you all for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with the Bitch Talk podcast on KCPW. This episode is supported in part by Black Rain, Studio Movie Grill, and Slopestyle Realty.
This is John Wildman. I'm here with Angela Tabora, and we're going to be talking about Mope, a Sundance film. And we've got an entire army here from Mope. So I'm going to have you guys actually introduce yourselves and say what you did on the film.
My name is Kelly Srai, and I play Tom Dong in the film.
My name is Lucas Hine. I'm co-writer and director of Mope.
I'm Nathan Stewart Jarrett, and I play Steve Driver.
My name is Max Adler. I play Chris Rochelle, who's one of the co-owners of the porn studio in Mope.
I'm David Arquette. I play the director, Rocket.
I'm Tanya Cornelisi. I play Tampa, the everybody's childhood sweetheart.
Lucas, we always start off these segments by letting our director introduce our listeners to the film. So tell us about the film.
So Mope is a true story about, it's set in 2010 in Los Angeles, about two low-level porn actors, which are called Mopes, as they're struggling to make it in the porn industry. And one of the main characters, Steve Driver, has trouble succeeding and goes on a dark rampage, dark spiral of destruction. So the movie chronicles the last year in his life. As him and his best friend, Tom Dong, they have a close friendship, and they get work at this studio called Ultima, where they have to do a lot of degrading, weird porn scenes. And it's just about how this crime happened. So it's a pretty dark, deep dive into this world that I had no idea about until I
I'm there are going to be some people that have no idea about this, I'm going to assume.
Yeah.
Tell us what a Mope is.
So Mope is the bottom of the barrel, low-end porn actor. Like a guy who does the dirtiest, most weirdest scenes, like a bukkake where you need 60 people. It's basically someone who is not going to succeed as a mainstream, huge porn actor.
Right.
Because of various
issues.
And when
we say huge porn actor.
Yeah. Literal and figurative. Right. But it's more of a psychological thing. There's a barrier they have that prevents them from being able to work with other people in a normal way.
Right.
So it's a combination of a number of things, but they just won't ever make it.
So let's talk about let's talk to the two guys who you looked at and you saw and said, these guys are low level porn actor types.
So initially, I was they're both very good looking guys. So that was at first that was a barrier. That was a barrier, but they were such good actors. They could just inhabit what these guys are like. Because someone who's not able to succeed in porn, it's not necessarily just about looks. It's sort of a weird thing. Like Steve Driver, for instance, he had a hygiene issue. And even when people would bring it up, he would never fix the hygiene issue. And he was shooting porn scenes, so you would think that's one of the main things he would need to have in check. But he just wouldn't. So both these guys, they were so good in their reads that I just thought they inhabited the characters. And it wasn't really about them... looking,
a hygiene issue.
It's about them encompassing the mental state of a Mope, which is kind of like a Travis Bickle type mentality. Maladjusted.
And Kelly, Nathan, I want to hear you guys talk about this because you are playing real life guys.
Yeah.
So there's always when you do that as actors, there's a different little responsibility. There's a different thing in your head,
And I think I don't know about you, but specifically with Steve. That he was on the fringes of society, that he was a low-level porn performer, that I felt like that responsibility was greater almost because he'd already been maligned in life, you know what I mean? So, there was a definite responsibility I felt in portraying what he believed he was and who he believed and how he could succeed. I tried not to wash, but apparently I'm the cleanest person in the world because I did not smell. I like didn't wash for a week, and it just wasn't really working. So I was like, you may as well just wash again because you're not stinking.
I wanted to go method,
and my body said no. But yeah, I felt more responsibility. Did you?
Yeah. I think a lot of us felt that we wanted to bring the humanity in these guys, and that was very important when we're portraying real characters, you know. And these guys, they had a dream, and that's really the main purpose of this whole film, is that they're chasing a dream. And even though it may be to become porn stars, it's something that we all can relate to, and I think it's a responsibility to show that it's, you know, everyone can relate to this chase.
And Max and David and Tanya, let me get you three in here too, because you know, people have preconceived notions of what it must be like to be on a porn set, and the people that are and sometimes those preconceived notions are right, a lot of times they aren't. So I would like each one of you to talk about, you know, how you found the right versus the wrong with the hotel.
I've been on lots of porn sets. I shoot my own everything.
That's where I recognize you from.
One of the first times I hung out with all these guys and with Lucas and Kelly Hayes, the producer. I'm going to say it.
He's totally going
to
say it.
They took us to a real life porn shoot at a house in the valley in California, and you're right. There are preconceived notions. There are things that you kind of think as like this fantasy world. Or it doesn't quite ground it in reality, but being there, seeing it, meeting the people, it was a job. It's a means to an end. It pays the rent, and it took it into like a real life grounded place. And I also play a real guy who is still alive, who had some traumatic things happen to him through this turn of events. And so I felt a big responsibility because I talked to him currently and he's going to see the movie. And so that was a big thing to again, keep it real and keep it grounded and do him justice and not make it a caricature.
David, what about you?
I don't know. I didn't visit the set. I can't imagine. I've been on a lot of crazy sets, so it was just really fun. I mean, it was a really great script and working with these guys. I mean, Nathan and Kelly, I was just so blown away by them I don't know, it's interesting, like even coming to Sundance, it's great to see them experiencing it. It's like, I don't know, I feel like a proud papa, although I'm not in any way. We only worked together for one day, but they're just so remarkable in the film, and you did such a great job directing it. It's just, I'm really proud to be back at Sundance and be a part of this great cast.
Well, yeah, and I want to get to Taunt here, but I did want to ask you about that, because anytime you have a situation where a cast is assembled like this, and they have one guy in particular, one woman in particular, that is kind of like the veteran that takes either the papa or the mama role, and they're at a big film festival, I'm always curious as to how you're helping usher everybody in. You know, how you're, because you've done this so many times. You've been through this. You've been at my film festivals, and so you know how this stuff goes. And they may not, you know. So are you saying anything, or are you just going sink or swim, kids?
No, a little. It's mainly like, let's all try to get in this party. There's a lot of us, but let's see if we can do it.
you threw a great one last night. Yeah. He welcomed us all. We felt like a part of it. It was really, it was great camaraderie.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. We must have missed the invite for that one. I must say, not only is this one of the best-looking crews, but they're the best dancers. We had some fun last night before your party, David.
We might get Tanya in here.
Tanya,
not simply from you know, being an actor trying to portray America's sweetheart kind of role in this, but also the perspective of, you know, of a female, of an act, female actor in that world, because you're bringing something different to it.
My character never signed up for the porn world and never even knew she was really involved in it until it was too late. Kind of caught up in a bad situation. I'm really just trying to get a good night's sleep and some food and shelter. So it was, for my character, she's trying to make the best of her life right now, and that is, you know, she's on the street and Nathan's character, Steve Driver, picks her up and brings her home, and it's not what she signed up for. So it's the journey that I went in was, as soon as I knew I was involved with that, was to get the hell out of there, basically. Yeah.
I hear that. All right, Lucas, I'm going to come back to you. And when you have a cast of this size, people have different methods. Okay. Sometimes literally a method of working. They take different time getting to that spot that you want everybody in, that medium level. Some are awesome first takers. Some people, it takes them a while to build up to it. How did you manage in directing in the group sense to kind of get everybody in the same place at the same time?
So I like to shoot long takes with a fluid camera that can go 360. So in many cases, we would shoot the entire scene in almost every shot. And so the visual aesthetic was inspired by The Wrestler. And so I wanted this sort of raw documentary feel, like you're really there. And so I could, usually it was one or two cameras, two sometimes, but we would just run the entire scene. And sometimes we would do it 10 or 15 times so we could try different stuff. But my entire approach for visuals was to allow the actors to have as many takes as possible. And so I think by doing these long takes and getting into the scene, it wasn't like I was, I wasn't breaking up the coverage into like micro coverage, doing this. It allowed for a very loose style of shooting. So then it translated to the editing room. So that's the approach I'll continue to do from now on, because I had such a great experience. You know, even though it was a tiny, short shoot, we could do 10 takes usually almost every time.
How long was the shoot?
So basically the principal shoot was 15 days, and then we did a day or two of pickups. So it was fast.
Wow.
It's fast. We basically had to shoot 9 pages. Like, the opening sequence was shot. It's like 9 pages. We shot it in one day. So we really didn't have time to think. We just had to go. And they were all pros. And, they were great. They brought stuff and elevated the script in cases, adding a lot for improv that just made it better. So I was so lucky to work with these actors. I mean, it was, every one of them was amazing. And, it was a dream come true.
Yeah, I think ultimately as director of a film like this, you hear porn industry, murder, but ultimately it's about people seeking acceptance and love and trying to find that balance between the two and the humanity in between.
Yeah, that's what drove me towards the idea. Like, I read the main character's suicide letter, and he said that he wanted to be a porn star to get a girlfriend. And once I saw that, I it made me sympathize with him. And so there's so many things like that that made me care about the real people. And that's why I wanted to do this story.
Okay, and we have to wrap up here, but for the final question, for you as the director, I always like to ask the directors, what was their eureka moment? Sometimes it happens, when you're shooting something and a particular take, and you go, oh my God. Sometimes it's in the editing bay. Yeah. For you on this film, what was it?
There's one scene, I don't want to spoil the scene, but the scene was so gut-wrenching when we shot it, that it involved most of the people here, and I just knew that they had captured something. It felt very real, and it was a complex scene. But I just knew that every person cast was the right call, and that was what I thought about the most in this movie. And it was that moment.
So that was the climax, if you will.
One of right? Yeah, the climax, perfect. Yes.
Well, fantastic. We've been talking to the team, almost the entire team, I think, from MOPE, which is screening at Sundance. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you very much.
And we are on one of our live remote interviews. Actually, not live. I guess we're taping this remote interview for the Festival Daily Buzz. This is John Wildman, and I'm here with Lindsay Wan, our producer, and also serving as a co-interviewer on this segment because we both totally love this movie. We're going to do a segment on the film Dirty God, and we have the director, Sasha Pollock, and the star, Vicky Knight. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you.
I am a big fan of this film, I'm going to say right now. And I love the fact that we were given a character who is not necessarily easy to embrace, but really wins us over in a genuine way. And Sasha, I would love for you to start off talking about
We'll have our filmmaker lead off by informing our listeners who haven't had a chance to see the film what the film is about. So why don't you, we start off that, and then we'll go into what I've praised you about.
Yeah. Okay, Dirty God is a film about a young mother from London who is the victim of an acid attack by her ex. And the movie starts right after she comes out of the hospital, and she needs to find a way back into her life, dealing with her changed appearance and dealing with these scars, but also her emotional scars, and finding a way back into life.
You know, that we begin the film as she is being fitted for a clear lucite mask to protect, which I think is a wonderful metaphor, because it might protect the skin itself, but it's not going to protect her psyche and her and emotionally. And again, and I think you weave that, and Vicky gives a wonderful performance in this. So see, now I'm team Sasha and Vicky. But let's go back to that initial question. Again, you're not giving us an easy character to be on the side of. She is earning our respect and our allegiance. So what were the challenges to get to that? Let's take that approach. What were the challenges to make sure you did that?
Well, I like characters that are, in a way, honest, that are not likable from the start, but are real human beings with flaws. I think Jade in this film, she's trying so hard and she's failing, but trying again. Stumbling, falling, getting up, and trying to be a normal human being. And I think for me, Vicky gave so much light and energy to this story. I think she was really, really important to play Jade. I mean, she's really beautiful, and she has. She has so much bravura and life energy and humor that I immediately fell in love with her as a character.
I'd actually love to talk about how the relationship formed between you two. I know you saw a YouTube video of her talking about, was it the arson experience?
Yeah, so a few years ago I uploaded a video on social network YouTube and Facebook about how I got burnt as a child. I was in an arson attack 15 years ago, and I basically uploaded the video to educate people and make people understand what happened to me, and it was like basically a motivational video. I put it on Facebook and it went viral, and then I got a message from a lady called Lucy Pardee who asked me to play in Dirty God. So at first I was like, no, because I'd done this stupid program about people with disabilities who trying to find love, and they didn't actually tell me what the program was about until the end, and then they called it Too Ugly for Love. So they completely humiliated me on TV, and it went around the world to South Africa, you name it, it went to every country. So when Lucy approached me with this, I was refusing point blank. I didn't want to do it. And then she kept on and on and on for a whole year. I finally answered her, I called her, I met up with her, we did a self-tape, she sent it to Sasha and Marlene, the producer of Dirty God. Then we met a few months later, and then we did a long-winded casting process with other actors. And yeah, I mean, we formed this tight relationship. Now she's my best friend. she's an absolute angel.
And I mean, you have a full-time job as a healthcare assistant.
I do.
Is that
yes,
right?
Yes.
So what is it that pulled you into this project? Made you love the project? Made you trust Sasha? What was the difference between this project and the project that sort of wasn't what you were looking at?
I mean, when I was approached to do the film, I didn't get the script until a few months later, but we did some scenes from the script, like acting. But I was just thinking, like, you know, I want to give a message to the world. I want to give a message to these burn survivors. You know, anything is possible. And, you know, I've had a hard time growing up living with burns. I was bullied quite a lot, had name calling, things you wouldn't even imagine, you know, and I want to educate people that it's not okay to say things like that. And to do this film, it gives an insight on how it affects someone's ability to live with it. So yeah, I mean, that's why I've really wanted to like give the message to people.
Well, let's talk about what it was like on the set.
Yeah.
Because you know, when you're not someone who's pursuing acting and on the sets constantly, and you know, and you're thrown into a project that is this significant, and you find yourself on the set, people are often shocked to discover how boring sets are, and how long it takes, oftentimes to film scenes or accomplish that. From your perspective doing this, and because so much of this is on your shoulders,
Yeah. What
was that process like for you?
Oh, I loved it. I loved every second on set. I mean, I was in every single scene on set. I was in special makeup for three hours, and then beauty makeup for 45 minutes to an hour. Even that I loved. The makeup truck was the party truck. You know, there was such a good vibe. So yeah, I mean, I loved every single second on set. It was amazing. I want to do it again.
So, Dirty God 2 sequel?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes.
Sasha, let's talk about the editing process. Mm-hmm. Because oftentimes a filmmaker like yourself will kind of find the film during that part, as opposed to actually during filming or the scripting process. And especially in a film like this, where there's such attention to nuance, to building that journey of Jade's. Talk about that.
Well, I think like every phase you sort of start over. You have, of course, the script phase, then the shooting, then the editing, and you sort of start. It's a new beginning. And during this film, I had the script, of course, but then we improvised a lot. Vicky gave so much to the film, and as I'm from the Netherlands and this film was set in London, I wanted to feel authentic, and I had these young actors, so they helped me a lot with the slang, and I think one of the most beautiful scenes are improvised, and I always like to do that. So then in the editing you sort of start as a documentary maker in a way, because you have lots of material that you don't really exactly know yet how to use it, but for me those things are sort of intuitive. I always say on the beginning of a shooting day, oh yeah, last night I had some other ideas, I would like to try them out, and then production most of the time says, okay, we will do it if we have extra time. But then my producer, Marlene Slot, who was amazing, she was like, no, this is important for Sasha, it's important, it's even more important than the scenes that are in the script, so we are shooting them.
So. I'd like to have both of you talk about what was the toughest scene to shoot. You, from a technical standpoint, Sasha, and then Vicky, you from a performance standpoint. What was the biggest challenge?
You start.
I think talking, like the scene where I'm in the car wash and I'm talking about what happened to me, that brought back a lot of memories from my own accident. And plus it was a night shoot as well, so everyone was really tired and I had to explain what had happened, and then I put some of my own story into it as well. I found that quite difficult as well. And also the masturbation scenes as well was quite intense, because obviously I've hid my body for 15 years, and to get it out on set and to show the world, you know, the real scars and not just the prosthetics was very, very difficult for me. But in the end, with the support of Sasha and all the crew, it became easy towards the end. So yeah.
For me, scenes that are difficult are scenes when things get technical in a way with body doubles and stunts. Most of the time, because I really like to get into a flow and find authenticity, and then when you have to break things up and you need like a stunt double, for instance, we had a great scene and she did so wonderful, and I didn't use it in the film, but in the house party in the beginning, she would jump out of a window onto something and would do sort of a dance. And that scene, she was blowing everyone away, but I had to cut it. But that was a difficult scene to do, because we needed an extra person to jump out of the window and things like that.
I mean, I was willing to do it, but they, health and safety, wouldn't let me. So.
Now, Vicky, I'm assuming that you've seen this. You've seen the film.
I have.
Okay. And what was your emotional reaction that first time that you saw the completed film?
Before I saw the film, I was a bit like, oh, am I going to watch myself or am I going to see a character? But when I see it, I saw a character. I didn't see myself. And I was, well, I've still got no words for it. I'm proud of myself, you know, that I've done this. You know, I've made a movie. Like, I made a movie. What the hell? My first movie. And we're in Sundance. Like, it's crazy.
I know.
It's a dream.
It all goes downhill from here. I'm sorry to tell you that. No, something tells me it's not going to go downhill from here.
No, we can only go up.
Because Dirty God is a wonderful film. We've been talking with Sasha Pollock, the director, Vicky Knight, the star. Congratulations to both of you.
Thank you.
We're wrapping up the Festival Daily Buzz on KCPW, kcpw.org, bff.fm, and kfog.com. This show is made possible with the support of KCPW and Slamdance Film Festival. Our sponsors include Black Rain, hemp-infused products that focus on wellness, relief, and recovery, Studio Movie Grill, opening hearts and minds one story at a time, and Carolyn Cremel of Slope Style Realty of KW Park City Keller Williams Real Estate. Additional support is provided by Nasty Women Wines, Pro Bar, Uinta Brewing, Couple Co. Podcast, and Whole Foods Market in Park City. This show is audio produced by Charlene Goto with production help from Angela Rowling and Sophie Gunther. Our executive producer is Lancia Wan.
Tune in tomorrow, which will include interviews with the cast and crew of the Slamdance film Happy Face and director Alexander Philippe of the film Memory, The Origins of Alien. See you then.